Welcome to the Feed Central Hay Matters podcast, your go-to source for all things hay-related in Australia. I'm your host, John Paul Driver. In today's episode, we're joined by Dr. Andrew Walter. Andrew, among many other stations in life, serves on the AgriFutures Export Fodder Advisory Panel. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you, John, for having me.
My degree is in economics, agricultural economics. I actually worked at my university hosts the Western Center for Risk Management Education, farm policy and crop insurance type education work. I worked for an agricultural lender for 6 years, and then I work for the university now as the farm and ranch management specialist. So a lot of work on ag policy, and I also sit on the Washington State Hay Growers Association board. We have one forage researcher left in Washington State at the university. We've been told that they're not going to replace his position unless the hay growers comes up with $7 million to fund it. So that's been one of my causes here in the last year, is trying to find $7 million to endow a chair and keep that position funded so we maintain any level of forage research in Washington State, which should make anybody in Australia feel really good about collecting an assessment, a levy.
Look, I think we're very lucky to have the system that we have in Australia, where we have a levy on all a full range of our agricultural products, whether that be grain or hay, livestock, wool, and the like, cotton, and that's fed back into a formalised research and development program for each industry. And having travelled around the world a number of times in various capacities, I do think that Australia has a great advantage with that system. And I think sometimes industry and to some extent our research providers take it for granted because it has been in Australia for more than two decades.
As a point of interest, we have it for everything except hay. We have tree fruit and berries and wheat and potatoes and cattle and everything except hay.
And we've only recently, in the last 5-6 years, had our levy on hay in Australia. And the challenge was to find what's called an endpoint royalty. Where is the end that you can capture the collection of hay? And it came down to being an export fodder levy. That was the one point where we could actually capture a levy on hay. So it's the export hay. So I sit on the AgriFutures Export Fodder Advisory Panel. I have to emphasise that it's export fodder, and that accounts for roughly 10% of Australia's cereal hay production. So I say that, you know, we're doing the R&D on 1 in 10 bales of hay that are produced in Australia, but there's a lot of flow-on effects and benefits too.
Oh, of course. The variety development and absolutely.
Yes, yes.
One of the things I want to do here is a little rah-rah for AFIA. I find a lot of value in those associations.
I think it's incredibly important. AFIA is the peak body for the Australian fodder industry. It brings together everybody in the supply chain, from seed companies, machinery manufacturers, twine, plastic wrap suppliers, transporters, farmers, growers, export traders, domestic hay traders, the whole lot get to come under the one banner. And I think it's a very important organisation for being able to talk to government, the media and the broader community.
I'm going to come at this as somebody asking for advice. Again, that compare and contrast. We don't have really good national and to a certain level state representative representation for the hay industry. What's made Australia successful?
I think it really comes back to the founding people of the Australian fodder industry back in the late 1990s. They identified a critical problem in the quantitative assessment of fodder and trying to get greater accuracy and relevance from the quantitative data analysis of hay. And that was really the foundation stone for AFIA. And then everything else sort of followed through about how to grow it, bale it, process it and market it better. But that was the foundations, and even today, that's still a major component of AFIA. I think the networking opportunity that the organisation allows or encourages is particularly important and beneficial to everybody that's involved.
I understand that you were an advisor to John Howard.
I was, yes.
Can you talk about how that experience, really a national government, has aided the direction of the forage industry? How does that experience in politics relate to experience in the hay industry?
Well, just to give a little bit of background, I've worked in a whole range of roles. Nothing quite as exciting as yourself, John Paul, but I've worked in a range of government and business roles. And I do confess to having done some policy work for the Office of Prime Minister and Cabinet. The background to that was that I, at the time, was the coach of the Australian Biology Olympiad team and head of the Australian Science Olympiads. And so I had to have a good understanding of science in a range of disciplines. Then I had to be able to communicate it. And I think one of the things when you're involved in education is you need to understand your subject material and be able to break it down into bite-sized snippets that's relevant to the audience. By accident, throughout life, I've had to be able to break down different technological subjects into bite-sized elements for people to be able to receive and digest. When you're talking to our political leaders, you've got to cast the information that you convey in a different way as if you're giving an academic presentation in our national research organisation, CSIRO, where I did my PhD, to a bunch of farmers that might be my neighbours back on the family farm. So you've got to be able to cast the information that you're wanting to convey that's relevant. And look, it was a great... I've worked for a whole range of governments from small local government, the state governments, national government in Australia and overseas. Likewise, I've worked in the business sector from small micro companies up to the largest of the multinationals. And it's been a great privilege to be able to work in all of that. And in a way, I feel very privileged. I'm not necessarily that athletic, but I note that there are people who are athletic are very easily able to adapt to different sports, and they do it pretty easily. I was blessed with parents who gave me the genetics and the environment where I was able to work hard, and I just had a love of learning. So I'd rather be in the library at uni than out partying. I am the ultimate nerd, and I think that was a blessing. And in a way, it's similar to when people learn multiple languages. They can adapt easily from one language to another. And so I say to people that I'm blessed that I have the capability, if I can say modestly but quite frankly to you, that I am able to understand one area of science and technology, and then it's rather easier to be able to adapt to other areas of science and technology. Are called upon to give advice and come up with ideas on a range of science and technology policies in a range of environments.
How did you get to the fodder industry?
Well, I was born and bred on a farm at Violet Town in northeast Victoria. Right from, I think my father had me standing on the ute seat as a three-year-old steering the ute as he fed hay off the back tray of the ute. And then I graduated to the tractor, I think about 8 or 9 years of age. And I remember driving my first, as you would call it, combine harvester. We call them a header.
Yep.
In Australia, at 12 years of age, I got to do, we had a tractor-drawn, PTO-driven combine harvester in those days.
Yep.
And I got to do one lap of the paddock when Dad was having his lunch. And I'd hang out all day in the Australian heat just to do one lap. Yeah. And I can remember in my second year that I was now a 13-year-old, and we just bought the first tractor with an air-conditioned cab in the district. So to have an air-conditioned cab on a tractor with a PDO-driven combine harvester behind it, like, we thought we were fantastic. And I got to do a lap around the paddock, and there was one part of the paddock where the crop was really quite heavy, and I didn't want to slow down to a lower gear, so I kept her in top gear because I wanted to prove how good I was. And I managed to block it from the back of the straw walkers to the front of the cutter bar. So we then spent 4 or 5 hours unblocking the combine harvester. And I think it was a really valuable lesson at 13 years of age to be aware of what you're doing.
There's something in there about going slowing down to go fast, and there's all sorts of really good lessons in that exact experience.
There is, and it's about being appropriate for the task at hand.
Yes.
And I think in my various roles, I think those early childhood lessons served me very well. My mother was a person who went to her grave never telling a lie, and she could not stand anybody telling a fib or inaccuracy or stretching the truth or anything like that. And I must confess that I did try to get Mum to write a school note when I had 3 science assignments due simultaneously, that, you know, I had to help the dog because the dog had been sick.
Mum
was not into that. No, she would not do it. She was like, no, that's lying, Andrew. You explain your situation. You communicate your situation. I am not going to do that. And God bless Mum. It was about honesty and integrity from Mum's perspective. And my father was an exceptionally hard worker. He started off in life with not much, and in fact, for the first year of his life, he was having regular blood transfusions. He was in a very poor family. One of his philosophies was, never worry about what you don't have, be thankful for what you do have, and make the best of what you've got. And you don't get to choose your parents, and with the benefit of hindsight, I was blessed with the best parents, which gave me a great love of the land. And I think, you know, standing on the ute seat as a 3-year-old steering the ute, I can remember the first time when I was like 10 or 12 years of age, driving the tractor, feeding the cattle, that I actually could actually change gears. I had enough strength in my legs to be able to push the clutch down to change the gears. Then I remember blocking the header or the combine harvester up.
Yes.
I never lived it down. And I just had a great passion for farming, and I wanted to learn more. And I knew that if I wanted to go to university, we were that poor that I couldn't afford to go to uni without a scholarship, so I worked really hard, and it was a natural linkage that I loved learning. So I got really good marks and got a full scholarship to go to uni. I was quite good at science and won different scholarships as a student. One of them was to attend the National Science Summer School, which was at those times sponsored by Rotary in Canberra, yeah. And that was to inspire senior secondary school students to pursue a career in science. And I sort of went back as an alumni saying what I was studying and learning at university. And in that role, I became aware that the Australian Science Olympiads program in those days was running Olympiads for chemistry, physics and mathematics. We're looking at setting up a biology program. And I was encouraged to apply to be the inaugural coach of the Australian Biology Olympiad team way back in 1992. And we went into the International Biology Olympiad, which, if you like the Olympic Games for biology.
Yeah.
And that year was in the Czech Republic, and the Iron Curtain was just falling, and we had the International Biology Olympiad in the Czech Republic that year, and I make the analogy to people that in a race car analogy, we were lapped before we'd even got over the start-finish line by our other competing teams. We were woeful. But we were, I hopefully, quite reasonable about coming so badly last that they gave all of the Australian team members, which was four, an award for special merit in participation. I come back to Australia in my early 20s, wrote up a report to say what we should do for the next year, and our Australian Academy of Science said, well, we think you should go in 1993. And in that year, the Biology Olympiad was in the Netherlands. In car racing analogies, we were bumper to bumper until the end of the race, and China just beat us by the smallest of margin. We come second in the world, but we are out of our four team members, we had one team member, Anna Baum, who won the competition outright. And it was the first time that a Western nation representative had won the Biology Olympiad outright, and the first Australian, and she was also the first female. And it created a lot of international media attention from the global TV networks that, you know, these Aussies had, yeah, had a quote from the lingo from your part of the world was we had kicked butt and had done really well. And in the 1994, Anna became the Young Australian of the Year, and therefore I was the coach of the Young Australian of the Year. So I got to meet lots of political representatives in that capacity. Then when we had a change of government, the Howard government come in 1996, I then had various roles through secondment to help in the political scene. And part of the my role then, I was doing a PhD in plant molecular biology, was to talk about plant genetic engineering and the merits and benefits of it.
Yeah.
And helped get some of the legislation through our Houses of Parliament, and that's where I had roles in talking to politicians, media, environmental activists and the like about genetic engineering, which today looks so trivial, but in those days it was going to be like some people thought as the end of the world.
Yeah, of course.
We were all going to grow multiple ears and have multiple arms and legs on us because of GM food, but thankfully, and we were pretty confident that it was not going to lead to the negative outcomes that our opponents thought, but it was a tough debate. Oh, look, I honestly think, John Paul, I am the luckiest man in the world to have done what I have done, where I've been able to do research and technology literally with Eppendorf tubes in a laboratory wearing a white lab coat, to doing experiments on the farm, on the back of the tray of the ute with the dog puffing in my face, to working for some of the largest biotech companies around the world. That it's been a wonderful privilege and journey. None of it's been planned. It's basically all been by accident. But I think it's been about a love of science and technology and people and business. And that would be the summary of Andrew Walter. Just love people, love business and love science and technology. And I'm very, very lucky that all of those elements have combined to give me the life experience and opportunities that it has.
I understand that you still operate a contracting business.
Yes.
How is all of that related back to the contracting business?
Well, my father started that, and literally that's what put me through uni. I think Dad would have started doing contract hay making and harvesting in the 1970s, and we're still doing it now. Obviously on a different, more modern machinery and on a different scale, but we go from the top of Australia to the bottom of Australia. We, in your language, we're contracting over a 2,000-mile north-south distance.
The next time somebody gives me a hard time for having fields spread out over 35 miles, I will inform them that I am nowhere near the record holder
We've just had the National AFIA Conference and the National Heavy Vehicle Regulators come in attendance, and I normally have a few questions and comments to make to them about the absurdity of some of the rules and regulations with regard to the movement of machinery and indeed just general transport with heavy trucks in Australia. We've still got a long way to go. And I think that's one of the issues that I think that is happening in the modern world is that things are now being dumbed down so much to sound bites. And if I could observe from my observation of being involved in the policy industry leadership role in the last three decades, it's been a shift from the early days where there was a real focus on the core science and technology facts. You can't get away from the basic laws of chemistry and physics. And you can have as much media spin as you like, but those facts can't go away. And I sit on a few business boards and in industry advisory boards, some with a science and technology bent, just some with just a purely business bent. One's actually in aged care for a community group. And I think there is, as a general comment, a big dumbing down on science and technology. And we have a push in this country, in Australia, of trying to make science simple. I say, let's make science digestible, but you can't change the basic laws of science.
I like the digestible comment in relation to fodder.
It is. And look, I have the privilege of sitting on the AgriFutures Export Fodder Advisory Panel, which is in charge of doing research for the benefit of the hay industry. And one of our key focuses is what makes hay of benefit for animals to consume. And if we just look at what a dairy cow consumes today to what it consumed 10 or 20 years ago, it is so remarkably different. Gone are the days where the cow just goes out and eats some grass and comes in, and when the grass isn't growing, you just feed it a bit of hay. Now you have all of these byproducts. You have computer programs mixing up total mixed ration diets. You know, there's a tremendous amount of science that goes into feeding them a huge diversity of product. And when you look at the production and the overall health benefits of the diets to the animals, it's totally and absolutely amazing. And that leads me on to one of my other philosophies, if you like, John Paul, is that agriculture is often seen as a sunset industry. You know, it's had its glory days in the sun. It's now getting all old and tired. It's backward. It's environmentally damaging and the like. And this leads to what I call the grandparent effect, where no grandparent wants their grandchild to go into farming or agriculture because it has floods, fire, drought. It doesn't have any modern technology. Well, you have a look at the latest machinery now. I've got some clients who are actually airline pilots, and they come in some of my farm machines and they go, wow, you've got satellite guidance to, in your language, fractions of an inch in our measurements within centimetres.
Oh, yeah.
When we're flying a jet aircraft, we're only within a couple of metres.
Right.
And we've got traffic control to help us do our job. You don't have that. And so one of my frustrations is, wearing my small business hat, is I get approached by schools saying, look, we have these students that are they're disruptive in the classroom. They're not really doing well in English or maths, but they're reasonably good at their hands. But look, we think they'd be really good to work on a farm. And my response is, well, what part of modern day farming allows you not to be able to read, write, do basic mathematics and be able to follow operating guidance principles? And I think this is a real problem about the image of agriculture broadly. Yes.
Have you happened to watch Clarkston's Farm?
Yes, I do. And I actually do enjoy it.
I think he's done more for the face of agriculture than any other human in history. Maybe Norman Borlaug and his Green Revolution, maybe. But Norman Borlaug's not nearly as famous.
Well, I totally agree with you, and I can't discount Clarkson's farmhand celeb. I think the duo,
yes,
do a really great job, and the banter that they sort of have. And look, it's true. 20 years ago, in my professional life, I had something like 3.5 full time jobs in various science, technology, leadership roles.
It's not just me.
Well, I was very impressed by the presentation you gave at last year's AFIA conference, courtesy of Feed Central. And I actually I gave a report to my colleagues in AgriFutures, who are focused on export fodder. I said, there was this American who came out, trades as the hay king. Yeah. He actually gave an assessment of Australian hay from a competitor's perspective. And it was really, really valuable and interesting. I wish I had the opportunity to have more time with you, John.
All we have to do is put it on the books. I hope you hear me saying that there's that opportunity to trade back and forth. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I do, and I think it's great. And going back to what I said about the perception of agriculture being a sunset industry, I actually make the pitch that it's a sunrise industry. The best days of agriculture are actually in front of us. Not behind us. Now, in Australia at least, we've got a huge push to try and mitigate so-called carbon pollution. Now, it's a biological fact that carbon dioxide is actually required for plant photosynthesis. And if we didn't have plant photosynthesis, we would all be dead. You can put as much media messaging and spin as you like on it, but that is the fundamental truth. At the recent AFIA conference, I actually asked a question of a group that were talking about the future and how we had to deal with the climate emergency. And I said, well, actually, is it a question about trying to mitigate so-called carbon pollution, or is it about trying to manage the effects of carbon pollution? Now, I'm certainly in the camp that I don't think realistically that we can balance the carbon emissions globally. We are burning historic carbon-carbon single covalent bonds. We're oxidising it, and as a result, we get carbon dioxide as a byproduct. That is a chemical and physical fact that we just cannot change. And in my view, if we want to get it to so-called net zero, the economic cost of that is going to be huge. Do we actually all want to give up our mobile phones, our motor cars, our aircraft,
airplane travel,
air conditioning, the air conditioning in our buildings? I have staff that work on the farm who complain they can't drive a tractor because I've set the temperature at 25 degrees Celsius and it's 27 degrees Celsius. Now, I can actually remember as an 11-year-old getting the chance to drive Dad's header without a cabin on it and just be in the open air with an umbrella over the top.
We still have an open station tractor that we run.
And I think they're great. How simple are they? You can hear what's going on. You're breathing fresh air. Okay, you don't get your Wi-Fi linked Dolby sound system
going.
There's
no auto steer.
I think there's actually perfection in simplicity. And in some ways, you know, you ask about my background working for government and industry, it was being able to break things down into digestible components that are relevant. And I've had some wonderful mentors throughout my career, and thinking about them coming onto this podcast, I think they were the foundation stones for the life that I've been able to build on. And starting with my parents, honesty, integrity, loyalty, hard work, then my PhD supervisors that were always about what is the actual result, not the result that you wanted to have from your scientific experiments, but actually what was the result, what was the procedure you went through. Then in my early stages of the Science Olympiads, it was about being reinforced that you must know your subject well if you're going to teach it, and be ready for those quirky questions from students and encourage questioning, encourage cross-examination. You know, they were wonderful foundations. And then when I got involved in business, I had a CEO of one of the largest mining companies in the world, and he was all about, you know, we might be running the biggest mining trucks, the biggest dirt diggers in the world, but it all comes back to people. You know, it's about managing people who can then manage the machines and the processes and the business and the science and everything else behind running a mining company. So, as I said, I think I've been wonderfully lucky and privileged, and I hope that I can contribute back to the community and industry in a way that that returns some of that goodness that's come to me over the years. And look, I try really hard. I'm normally somewhere where there's lots of troubles and problems that seems to follow me, but I do have a saying to the young apprentices in my business: I'd rather them make a mistake by doing something rather than make no mistake by doing nothing. But don't make that mistake twice.
You talked about mentors and parents and upbringing. My dad always said, right, wrong, or otherwise, do something. That was in that same spirit of learning.
Yes. And look, over the years, I've had colleagues, I've had businesses where something bad has happened and they get stationary. They stop doing things at all levels. It might be a mate of mine who was a really good football player. He blew his knee up. He just wanted to stop doing anything. And it's like, mate, if you're riding a push bike, you can't stay on the push bike if you're stationary. You need to be moving so you can actually adjust your trajectory and keep going. And I see that in all walks of life. You know, it's typical of farming around the world that they get to the stage in life where they think they need to retire. So I have a saying now, if you stop, you'll drop.
That's a good one and very observable.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that comes back to my PhD mentors and supervisors, which were all about observe, record, analyse and communicate. So you get to see things where you're looking at everything all of the time from a science and technology perspective. And I think the big challenge that we have in the Western world, globally, is the dumbing down of science. You can't get away from the basic laws of physics and chemistry. And I say, as a coach of the Australian biology team, and if I...
Do you still do that?
No, I don't. I did it for 12 years, and then I was the director of the International Biology Olympiad itself.
Really?
For a year, and that was a great... I loved that. We had 52 member countries, and one of my KPIs was to be in each member country at least once a year, which basically means you've got to be in a country...
Every week.
..once a week, every week. And, look, it was a great... It was something that I really enjoyed. We do have this problem where we're dumbing things down, and obviously I have a biology bent from a... professional training and activity perspective, and I would say biology is the interaction of chemical and physical phenomena based on mathematical principles. Biology is the science of life. It's the all-encompassing science. Now, sometimes this would get my physics and chemistry and mathematics colleagues a little bit upset, but I also had the privilege of being the executive director of the Science Olympiad, so I had a dual role to play, where I was the coach and director of the biology program, but I was also the, if you like, the director of the overall arching. But I would slip that in. But the point was, you can't have biology without good physics and chemistry and mathematics. And I think that's where the sciences are very complementary. And just like we were talking before, if you're very good at sport, you can often play multiple sports. And I think that's a natural extension into science and technology and academia. If you're really good at one area of science and technology, you can normally apply that systems of thinking and knowledge creation and recall into other areas. Now, of relevance, we're talking on a podcast sponsored by a hay firm. If you can make one type of hay, you're probably going to be pretty good at making different types of hay. And being able to understand what works in one area probably is going to work in other areas. There's a complementarity which makes it easier.
How do we more closely link the efforts of the AgriFutures Export Fodder Advisory Panel with our efforts in the States? Because we're in the same markets. If we're talking about export fodder, the Timothy that I'm growing is in direct competition to the oat and hay being grown in Victoria.
We would certainly welcome the opportunity to collaborate on the fundamentals. And I used to be involved in the committee that was the predecessor to AgriFutures. It was called the Riddick Fodder Crops R&D Advisory Panel. And I gave a paper presentation, which was we need to feed animals in the world, and are we going to base their diets on starch, i.e. grains, or are we going to base it on cellulose?
Right.
Now, we actually know that you've got to have some cellulosic-based feed in a ruminant diet for effective fibre functionality.
Yep.
And to try and encourage the animal to eat the diet. So it's not like you can feed them just grain. You can feed them just cellulosic-based fodder, but you're probably not going to get the performance results as you do now, where you've got a multitude of meals and grains going into the diet. And we are in a competitive market, and I thought the presentation that you gave last year to the AFIA conference from a competitor's perspective with your Timothy grass was absolutely fantastic. And internally, I reported it back as the AFIA conference last year was the best exporter-focused conference you could ever have. In complementing your presentation, we had presentations from the economists about the currency rates and economic growth in our target markets and the like. So all of that combined made it for a really great conference. The question that I would put back to you is, how do two key competitors work together?
I think we've already broached the subject about fiber digestibility, because I think that's something that we've all lost sight of.
Yes. And the role of fiber digestibility and non-digestible fibers and effective fiber in the diet, you know, from a technical perspective, part of the argument that we're now looking at in the AgriFutures Export Fodder Advisory Panel is what makes hay, hay. Now, you could say in a simplistic term it's just dead cut crop or grass that's packaged up.
Yep.
But I break it down into three primary components. There's the carbohydrate component, there's the protein component, and then where I think the opportunity for collaboration is what I call the other stuff.
Yep.
The long chain molecules, the aromatic molecules, the flavonoids and the like. And a little over a decade ago, we had a research project in Australia which was actually looking at what makes hay, the actual molecular mechanical basis on what makes hay attractive to animals to want to eat it. Now, all of us who've made hay, sometimes you can make the best looking hay, it looks perfect,
and
but the animals just don't want to eat it. Nothing eats it.
It's amazing.
It is. Now, we don't have an answer to that fundamental question of physics and chemistry as to why that animal doesn't want to eat that hay.
Right.
So what we do now is we put it in the TMR, we add a heap of meal and molasses, and we put attractive agents in it to make them eat it. But let's go back to the fundamentals. Why did that animal not want to eat that hay? And I think there's a great good news story with hay. Yeah, basically you can. If you've got the right hay, you can get an animal to consume 100% hay.
Yeah.
So my pitch to you would be, how about we work together as competitors in the global market of animal nutrition? How do we work together to make the market demand for our respective products greater?
Yeah.
What is it that you could breed into Timothy grass? Is there an alkaloid or a flavonoid or something that would make your Timothy grass better?
Yeah.
Because chances are it would also make our Australian oat and hay better. And we could actually get diets to have less grain, less meal and like, and a greater proportion of our cellulosic-based fodder. Now, as a competitor, I'm going to say if the customer in Japan and Korea's first choice should be Australian oat and hay. You're going to say it should be American Timothy grass. But I think the collective opportunity is to actually get them to want more cellulosic-based fibre.
And less grain.
Yes.
I've been formulating these digestible bite-sized pieces of policy. To use your vocabulary here, I really like that. To talk about climate change too, and as we think about lucerne, there's few crops that have a better story in relation to carbon than lucerne.
Yes,
that's a great story that we can tell. So in Washington State, we have our governor and legislature is almost exclusively focused on carbon emissions. Even though 100% of our electricity comes from hydroelectric or now wind and solar, because hydroelectric wasn't sufficient, we probably have the cleanest electricity in the world. And they're still focusing on nothing but carbon emissions. There's probably some, I mean, you're getting a little bit of a conservative and questioning perspective on this, but at the same time, we're about to lose our last forage research specialist from our university at a time when we need to be talking about less grain and more forage.
Yes, yes. And we have the same issues in Australia.
And I mean, these are the opportunities for that cross-pollination. How do we pitch these positions to legislatures, to governments, to help them understand the importance of fodder, these forage crops in relation to climate change, to carbon emissions?
Yes, and I think there is a real opportunity for agriculture to be a sunrise industry.
Absolutely.
On this topic.
Absolutely.
At the end of the day, we manage a lot of the land mass, and we have the enormous opportunities to be carbon sinks. But I also state, it's a fundamental that I don't think we're going to ever get to net zero. Now, there's going to be people that might, if this makes it to the podcast, distribution, there's going to be people say, oh my goodness, that's terrible. We've got a person who's saying we're never going to get to net zero emissions.
Somebody that doesn't understand how much carbon China is putting out.
Yes, yes. And the fundamentals that we're all based on, a covalent bond. One of my favourite topics, and because of the profile I have, I've got cousins and neighbours and whatnot who get a school assignment or a university assignment, and it's like, you know, Andrew, you know, we've got to address this carbon, we've got to address this climate change crisis that we're having. And I ask them, you know, well, what does it all come back to? What actually is a single covalent carbon bond? They've got no clues. And these are university graduates. This right. is such a basic fundamental. Mm-hmm. And I think this dumbing down of science is a real problem. And the way, when I was in the biology Olympiad, we went to so-called third world nations, and their respect and appreciation for the value of real science, because they didn't have much of it, was extraordinary. When I was the director of the biology Olympiad, I would go to a Western country and no one, when I walked through the airport, no one knew me, nothing like that. When I went to a third world country or a less capable country, I was put up on a pedestal. I couldn't move at the airport. People wanted my signatures. As a nerd, as the ultimate nerd, they wanted my signatures.
Right.
And I think it's because we have so much science and technology in the Western world, and it's delivered so much advantage. Think about the 1970s. We didn't have a microwave oven. In the 2020s, which kitchen in the world, in the Western world, doesn't have a microwave oven?
Very few. Yeah.
To heat your food up. And that was all back on the science and technology principles around electromagnetic radiation.
Right.
And when you say to people, that's not a microwave, that's an electromagnetic radiation emitter.
Yes.
They go, what are you talking about? That's not a nuclear power plant in
your
kitchen.
They have no concept, yes, of course.
They've got no concept. You talk about sunlight and what a photon is and what a photon is for a solar array. People don't know what a photon is today. Man, that is so basic.
Yeah.
So I get angry when I talk to educators about dumbing down science. And look, I have this issue at all levels. Of government and industry as well, and with my colleagues, about getting back to real science and the integrity of science, not just about media messaging and sound bites and the like. So I would welcome, and I think there would be a lot of colleagues of mine in Australia that would welcome the opportunity to really have a great collaboration with America on forage research. And I love travelling to North America and Europe for that matter, and talking about forage and how we can do it better and get some science. But it's hard stuff. You know, I'm associated with, or we've got some projects with AgriFutures at the moment where we're looking at the role of the different components, trying to fractionate hay into the different components to try and understand what their role and benefits are in the diet. Quite frankly, John Paul, to compete with you guys from America a
sure.
bit better. And it's been interesting. I have another role where I'm involved with Formula One race cars. You know, brand representation.
This doesn't surprise me at all.
That's a highly competitive industry.
Yeah.
Like, they don't share secrets between teams. But what's really great is that when there is something that needs to be addressed from a whole perspective of Formula One, they work together so magnificently well. And to me, they're like an ant species. They act individually with great competition as individuals, but when it's necessary, they work together as a collaborative group very, very effectively.
Yeah.
And I think that would be my pitch to you and your colleagues in North America, that yes, we might be at an individual level competitors, but our competition is really in the grains and byproducts area. We should be where we can working on some great collaboration. And that collaboration should be at an academic level, at an industry level, and if you like, when it comes time, at a grower-to-grower, processor-to-processor level.
Yes.
I think there's a lot more to be gained by that kind of collaboration. And that certainly, having done a PhD and worked in the academic environment, that's where you have a lot of peer-to-peer review of academic publications, but then you might be competitors for getting research grants.
Right.
But when you can, you do collaborative work. So I think there is a huge opportunity, and I know that AgriFutures would be very keen to explore every opportunity there was for international collaboration. And we have a mantra, and I'm not certain I get it always exactly right, but it's about collaborating, being real, being honest and being loyal. And I think in this global environment, our borders have broken down. We can do anything anywhere. We can basically fly anywhere in the world within about 24 or 30 hours. We can talk over the phone, over the internet without delay. You know, the world's become our backyard on all levels.
I don't think I'm overstepping my boundaries here by extending an official invitation to you to come and speak at the Washington State Hay Growers Convention, the Northwest Hay Expo in January.
Well, I would welcome that opportunity, John Paul. I'm not certain whether I'd have much to say that would be of any interest to you and your colleagues, but
I think you're way off the. That's the first thing that you've said that's been way off the mark.
John Paul, I might have to introduce you to some of my colleagues and family and neighbours. They might be able to give you the real view of Andrew Walter. But
interestingly, we have the U.S. Forage Export Council. I think maybe has 56 members. They likewise are fiercely competitive, but on issues of phytosanitary regulations in Japan or Korea or China, they act in lockstep. And it's exactly as you're describing.
Yes, yes. Now, well, I could be a little facetious in saying this. I'd welcome the opportunity because it would be an opportunity to learn more about the opposition. And one of the things I learned in politics was you have your friends close to you, but you have your enemies even closer.
Ah, yeah. You fully understand why I enjoyed my trip to Australia last year.
And you were very good at it, and I might say you had a very good host in Food Central, John Paul.
Few better, for sure.
Yes.
I expect that we could go on for hours more, and I hope to someday have a beer and do just that.
Yeah, I do too. Wherever that might be in this great globe that we have, I love what you do. I think you're part of the mantra of making agriculture be seen as a sunrise industry and not a sunset.
A big thanks to our guest for today. This podcast is proudly presented by Feed Central. Stay tuned in for our upcoming episodes.